Welcome to The Science of Economics, the podcast series of Bruegel, the Brussels-based economics think tank. Since the European Commission announced its vision about the new fiscal rules, the rules that were suspended at the start of the pandemic crisis, but are due to start sometime next year. The fiscal rules are one of Bruegel's favorite topics. Our internal email has been on fire. We thought it would be a great idea to bring this internal dialogue out to our audience, who will try to make sense of it all. My name is Mariam Demirtas, and I'm joined by Bruegel's director, Jeromen Zeldermeyer. Hi, Jeromen. Good to have you.
Thank you for having me.
And two of Bruegel's senior fellows, Gregory Claes. Hi, Gregory.
Hello.
And Zsolt Darvas. All three of them have written extensively on the issue. They're here with me today to discuss what we like, what we don't like about this new proposal. But we are going to start with a few description of what these new fiscal rules are. Jeromen, let me start with you. I was under the impression that it's very difficult for the European Commission to surprise us in any sense about bringing new rules out, given that this topic has been so much discussed at Bruegel and elsewhere. Can you give us a brief summary of what is this new proposal about?
Yeah, I think the proposal has surprised us in its boldness. So I think we had a sense of the direction. We didn't realize they would go so far. So they've gone very far intellectually, and they're also taking some political risks. So what is the most important new stuff for me? So the core of the proposal is really to replace what is now called the preventive arm of the so-called Stability and Growth Pact, which is the current legislation that governs fiscal policy in the European Union, and which for the most part consists of this collection of overlapping and sometimes confusing rules that attempt to map debt and deficit levels into adjustment requirements, right? So if your debt and your deficit is high in some sense, you're supposed to adjust, and there's sort of minimum requirements on how much to adjust, and there's a medium-term objective that you're supposed to follow, and all of this is based on formulas, and the formulas are modified by various things, but it's all kind of, in principle, a very complicated rules-based approach. And so what they would do is they would get rid of all of this and instead replace these rules-based adjustment requirements with a medium-term adjustment plan that every country would have to adopt. And this adjustment plan would be guided by debt sustainability analysis. And so, you know, unlike fiscal rules, debt sustainability analysis is something that very much allows room for discretion, but there is a structure to it, right? So there is a method to it, but very importantly, and so this is the sort of the main conceptual difference that I think most of us would like, is that DSAs, debt sustainability analysis, are supposed to take account of all relevant information for the future evolution of debt. So they're very open, they are very sort of case specific in their results. Now, what does this actually mean in practice? So in practice, it means that there would be a, if you like, structured negotiation process between the European Commission and the member country that would ultimately then lead to a result that may or may not be endorsed by the Council, so the ECOFIN. And it would essentially consist of three steps, this process. So in the first step, the Commission would propose what they call a reference multi-annual adjustment path in terms of net primary expenditure covering at least 4 years. So the key term here is net primary expenditure. And what this is it's a concept of expenditure that combines the elements of discretionary fiscal policy that governments can control. Namely, it would be expenditure net of discretionary revenue measures like changes in tax rates, and excluding interest expenditure as well as cyclical unemployment expenditure. And then the ambitiousness of this sort of net expenditure path would be calibrated to the level of debt risks, again, based on a debt sustainability analysis. So the Commission comes up with, you know, what is in effect a proposed expenditure ceiling, multi-annual for about 4 years for every country, you know, focused on these discretionary expenditure items that governments can control. And then in the second step, following a discussion with the Commission, the member state would make its own proposal, a counter-proposal. And importantly, they could propose a more gradual adjustment path then the Commission, provided that this more gradual path is underpinned by a set of reforms and investment commitments. So importantly, there's the sense that there might be a trade-off between how fast you need to adjust, how fast you need to bring down deficits via reduction or a slower growth in expenditure than expected from the revenue side, and reforms and investment. And the Commission says, you know, there would be a common methodology to assess this this trade-off. The final step would consist in the adoption or rejection of the member state's plan by the Council, so the ECOFIN, based on a Commission assessment. And then importantly, the communication states that in case there's no agreement between the member states and the Commission, then the original reference multi-annual net expenditure path proposed by the Commission would be used by the Commission and the Council for the purpose of fiscal surveillance and enforcement. So this is really important. So, of course, no one, not the Commission, not the Council, can force a member state to actually adopt a particular multi-annual net expenditure path. But what they can say is, if they don't like what's coming from the member, is, you know, for the purpose of the actions that we take in undertaking surveillance and you know, possibly imposing sanctions on you, we will stick to the Commission proposal for the expenditure path. Now, the question then is, what can the Commission, the Council do in principle to enforce this? Well, like in the current pact, the enforcement would happen through a thing called the excessive deficit procedure. And the primary trigger of this procedure would be the failure of a member state to comply with with the path endorsed by the Council, the expenditure path. And if this is the case, the Commission would propose to the Council an amended path. And, you know, the member would be asked, do you want to do this? And then if the member still doesn't want to do this, then in principle, there could be suspension of financial support through EU funds, as well as a thing called that they call reputational sanctions. So, you know, basically, it's sort of a naming and shaming. They could ask the Minister of Finance to come to the European Parliament and explain why they don't like to do the adjustment, which the Commission thinks it's right. And there would also be the continued possibility of sanctions in the form of fines, which is what is currently in the system. But here, quite interestingly, the Commission says, look, if you have very big fines, this is really not credible, particularly not for a country that is in trouble anyway, you know, that has an economic problem. And so they want to continue having this instrument, but they would lower the level of fines. So in effect, it becomes a variant of reputational sanctions. So in a nutshell, it's sort of a pretty discretionary way based on analytical methodology to find an adjustment path that countries are then supposed to comply with.
Thank you very much for this, Jeremy. That's a lot of detail here. But before we come into some of the things you said, I just wanted to go back one step, and maybe Zsolt and Gregory can help us do that. Can you compare and contrast the rules, how they were, and what is new in the rules right now? I mean, what about the debt limit and the deficit limit? What about the output gap? These things that were kind of always in the conversation, how are they changed in the current format of the rules? I don't know, Zsolt, if you wanted to go first.
A major change is that the current rules very much depend on unobserved variables, namely the so-called output gap, which is the gap between actual output and an estimated measure of potential output. And unfortunately, potential output can be measured very, very poorly. There's a large literature on that. And this indicator almost completely disappears from the new setup. I can qualify why I say not completely, but almost completely. And I think this is a great improvement because this output gap was used to estimate the so-called structural budget balance of the general government, which is an indicator of the underlying fiscal position. Because, for example, in good times when the economy grows fast, there are more tax revenues. In bad times, there are less tax revenues. And these cyclical factors are taken out from this underlying measure of the budget balance, which is conceptually a very intuitive concept. But because of enormous measurement errors, this is a very unreliable indicator. And the current framework very strongly relies on this structural balance. Namely, countries have two types of conditions that they have to meet. First of all, they have a so-called medium-term objective of what structural balance they have to reach by 4 years from now. But also the annual adjustment, which is even more problematic, is defined in the current framework in terms of changes to this structural balance. And basically, governments cannot estimate, cannot control that. And now the current framework almost completely gets rid of that. So this is a big, big change. So changing the operational indicator, which was unobserved, is now changed to the net expenditure, as Jeromin has described, which is observed minute by minute and fully under the control of the government. So this is a big, big improvement in my view. The other major change is the debt that you also mentioned. That, you know, the EU treaty says that the public debt to GDP ratio should be no more than 60% of GDP. But if it is more than that, it should diminish and approach that 60% at a satisfactory pace, which in 2011 was calibrated by the so-called 1/20th debt reduction rule, which means that if a country is over 60%, then the gap to the 60% has to be reduced each year by 1/20th, so 5% of the gap. So this is a blind numerical rule applicable to all countries the same way, irrespective of what their fiscal position is. And we also made some calculations on about what kind of fiscal adjustment would be needed now by European Union countries, and concluded that for almost half of the countries, there would be a really big upfront fiscal adjustment to meet this debt reduction rule. And again, a good news from the proposal that this 1/20th debt reduction rule is also completely disappears.
Yeah, okay. So, Gregor, I come back to you then. So just to be clear on the changes here, right? So we went from having to measure the adjustment of the output gap, which is an unobservable thing, into having to into using a rule that is a lot more observable, that is the expenditure rule that Jeromin described. The debt reference, the 60%, is that eliminated or is that de-emphasized? Gregory?
There are still some constant. Actually, yes, the reference values that are in the treaty, because the Commission does not envisage that the treaty will be changed, they stay there. So the 3% reference value, the 60% reference value, they stay there, but they are treated in a different way. So 60% becomes like a very long-term objective in the sense that it's still there, for instance, to distinguish countries that don't have problems, some countries that have moderate or substantial financial stability, fiscal sustainability risk. So it's there, but it's like a long-term objective. The 3% is still there, and countries should maintain their deficit below the 3% because the excessive deficit procedure, Jeromin mentioned that there is a new EDP that is based on the fact that you deviate from the plan, but the old excessive deficit procedure that is there when you breach the 3% deficit will still be there. So the 3% and the 60% will continue to appear in the fiscal framework, but with a different role. However, as Jeromin and Jolt explained, I really think that this represents a substantive change in the overall philosophy of the rule. Before, in my view, we had like some form of micromanagement of yearly non-observable and, as Jolt said, mismeasured variable. While now we move towards a focus on medium-term risk to debt sustainability that also allow for stabilization and investment. So, in my view, it's a big change in the philosophy of the fiscal framework.
So a big change in the philosophy, but is this an improvement? So do you believe, and Jeremy, I'll come back to you, this de-emphasization, if I interpret it this way, we're emphasizing the 60% and the 3%. We're de-emphasizing the speed at which we need to get back to something that is more sustainable, but we're emphasizing the way we're getting there. Is this a good summary of the new change in spirit, what Gregory described?
Yes, I agree with what Gregory said. So maybe the very short summary is that the new system is the same as the old system in the sense that 60% debt and a maximum of 3% deficit continue to be the reference values. And then the question is, what happens for countries that have higher debts or deficits? And here the treaty says they have to reduce their debt at sufficient speed to get to back to the 60% or less, and the deviations from the 3% can only be temporary, right? So this is the built-in, this is the hardware of the treaty. And essentially what then the implementing legislation, the Stability and Growth Pact, does is it puts flesh on this notion of temporary deviations or sufficiently fast debt reduction. And that sort of flesh in the past has taken the form of, like Jolt and Grégory said, sort of these rules that kind of try to define minimum structural adjustment based on, you know, some observables, but they are problematic for many reasons. The two main reasons why they're problematic is because the actual adjustment itself is expressed in an unobservable term, so that it's very error prone. But then for me, the even bigger problem, of course, is that when you subject this to rules, you are missing all kinds of relevant information that you sort of forgot when you wrote down the rule. And so this is a radical improvement in two respects. It gets rid of the unobservable targets that have to be estimated. But then the other thing is it basically removes the rules and it replaces them by a requirement of having to consider all information that is relevant to debt risks and to the trade-off between reducing debt fast and possibly not being able to attain other objectives of fiscal policy, like using fiscal policy for macro stabilization or public investment. So it takes a super holistic approach, right? All information should be used. And the tool for using all this information is a stochastic debt sustainability analysis. And, you know, we come from this from different angles. So, you know, Grégory and Jolt, they're happy because the commission got rid of these output gap-based measures. I'm happy because, you know, in my past work with Olivier Blanchard and Alvaro Leandro, we have been telling the commission to use DSAs, and this is exactly what they're doing. So we are all happy for different reasons, you know, complementary reasons. However, you know, there are also some issues with this proposal.
Yeah, we're going to get, I'm sure there's lots of pieces actually, but I mean, just to summarize, because I think that's important to understand how the philosophy has changed. I think what has come now into the core of the issue is the debt sustainability. We really don't care about your fiscal policy provided your debt is sustainable, right? I mean, I think that, and to, you know, to evaluate that, and I'm sure you're going to have things to say on this, we're going to get all the information that we need to evaluate whether your debt is sustainable. So I think that's an important difference. Whereas previously, the emphasis on the deficit was you know, what happens every year was just as important as what happens in the long run, or not, Grégory?
I just wanted to make a point very clear, because we are talking about debt sustainability, but I think also what the Commission proposal does is to give a definition of that. By sustainable debt, they mean that the debt to GDP ratio needs to be on a declining and continuously declining path for a number of years. The number of years is not exactly clear. It's like 4 + 10 or 7 + 10 years, so long period. But that's the objective. The objective is to be on a clear declining path for the debt to GDP ratio.
But for everybody? Everybody needs to be in a declining path of the debt, even the countries with a low debt?
Only if you're above 60%. And then there is a sense that you have to get on that declining path faster if you have high debt risks, which I evaluated again using debt sustainability analysis. However, what exactly declining means, because they have a stochastic concept, is unclear, right? And this year we are then coming to effectively the weaknesses, or at least the incompleteness of this proposal, which we can talk about as soon as you give us the green light to move to that topic, Maria.
But before I do that, Jean, I just wanted to give you the opportunity to say, what is it, I mean, if there is one thing, and we've heard a number of different things, that you thought was actually a big improvement in this new philosophy, what would that be? You mentioned the fact that the unobservable nature of the previous rule is now replaced with observable. Is there anything else that you think is particularly interesting in the current proposal?
I would add two more important issues. One is the consideration of public investments. I mean, the Commission stated, I mean, I look through the report and find reference to public investment more than 10 times in the document. It says that if countries put forward a credible plan for reforms and investments, which can, I mean, and the Commission can verify that it will boost the growth of the country in the medium term, then the adjustment path can be slower. I think it's also an important change. And secondly, I mean, the whole package is not just about fiscal rules, but more generally the overall economic governance framework of the EU. So it also includes some new provisions for the so-called macroeconomic imbalances procedure. For example, the document notes very well, which we have said also at Bruegel many times, that the currently existing macroeconomic imbalances procedure doesn't work really well. Countries that face strong pressure from the markets with high deficits, they all had to adjust. But countries having large current account surpluses, they didn't have, you know, any pressure to change, neither from the markets nor from the European Economic Governance Framework. And again, this whole package also brings or aims to bring the macroeconomic imbalance dimension to the economic governance framework of the EU.
So as you say, as Jeremy said, this is a much more holistic approach, right? It's just, it is an attempt not to have all the procedures working in isolation, but actually in collaboration with each other, right?
Again, and I think this is a very versatile new philosophy. So I very much endorse the underlying idea behind it.
We're going to come now to the weaknesses, Jeremy, but I think we must reflect also a little bit, I mean, the context of these rules in a bigger framework, which includes also the RRF, right, which is now coming forcefully into operation. And how do the two link together? But let's talk about how you think, Jeremy, if I start with you, how do you think the framework is incomplete and basically falls short of making a real difference?
It's incomplete in the sense that it doesn't have a convincing answer to the question at this point of how abuses of discretion, and by abuses, I don't mean necessarily, you know, badly intentioned abuses. I mean, you know, abuses to the fact that at any given point in time, there's always an incentive to postpone adjustment, you know, to try and adjust in the future rather than today, because today you're also dealing with other problems like fiscal stabilization or public investment. And so the inherent problem of discretionary decision making is that it leads to excess debt and deficits. And that is precisely the role of the fiscal rules to control this problem, right? So moving to much more discretion gets you back to the basic question of, well, is this going to constrain governments enough, right? And so the Commission says, well, we are going to use debt sustainability analysis to constrain ourselves. But at this point, it is rather vague how they want to do this. And what they also say is they give, if you like, something like a minimalistic fiscal rule that would provide a guardrail, if you wish, to discretion, which is a minimal adjustment requirement. And roughly the way they define this is that the reference path that they start off with in this process of negotiation with the member countries must lead to what they call a plausibly declining debt path after 4 to 7 years. So if you are a sort of a high risk, or as they call it, substantial risks debt country, it would be after 4 years, unless you have a really good idea on reforms and investment, and then you might get another 3 years, so it would be 7. If you are not sort of this high risk, but sort of a medium risk case, then from the beginning, you can take 7 years to come up with this plan, or the Commission can propose a plan that would take 7 years, and then only at that point is there a real requirement for the debt to begin to decline continuously and for the deficit to be less than 3%. And so that sounds basically really weak, right? I mean, if you have a high-risk countries, you really want the debt to decline much, much faster than that in general. And so the question is whether this proposal would achieve that or not. Now, in defense of the Commission, they have not defined what they mean by plausibly declining. And so if by plausibly declining, they mean declining debt with sufficiently high probability, then in order to get the debt to start declining with high probability after, say, 4 years, you actually need to do a lot of adjustment from the beginning. And in fact, you might see that the median expected debt path already starts declining immediately, right? Because you need to get the debt to decline with sufficiently high probability. So this offers a potential way out of this conundrum.
Who defines what plausible means?
It's not clear, right? So we have done an event with Martin Favet, the Director General for Economics and Finance of the European Commission, and I asked him, what does it mean? And he said something conceptually to the effect of what I've just stated, but then I asked him, well, what's the probability that you're targeting? And he said, we're still thinking about that, okay?
Yeah.
So at this point, the Commission has not really, I mean, or let me put it the other way. I think this communication can really be faulted for not being clear, not even with adjectives, on the degree of ambition that the Commission intends to pursue, and really giving fodder to the notion that the Commission might actually give a much lower weight to fiscal adjustment in its overall trade-off of policy objectives in this proposal than it has done in the past, right? Another aspect that could lead one to this conclusion is that they are talking about the minimal requirement being a 3% deficit after 4 to 7 years. And of course, to have sort of 3% as the quote-unquote target in the medium term is much weaker than what is commonly viewed as the medium-term target under the present understanding of the fiscal rules, which would be a deficit that is near zero, so something close to a balanced fiscal position. Yeah. Now, the Commission said it's not that we are targeting the 3%, we are targeting, you know, the 3% or a plausibly declining debt path, whatever is tougher, so to speak. But since they haven't said much about what plausibly declining means, that gives them a huge amount of discretion, and we don't know at this point how they're going to use this discretion. So that is the main weakness. And if I can just slip in the second one, the other weakness, which is separate, is that it's a really Commission-centric proposal. So the Commission is putting itself completely in the driver's seat here. And that, I think, is a little bit in tension with its professed objective in this communication to strengthen ownership at the national level. So I think they're sort of talking the talk on increasing national ownership. They're not walking the walk in this proposal.
So let's bring, I'm sure Gregory and Zolt have views on these degrees of discretion. So Gregory, if I come back to you. So I think what I understood from Jeremy, he worries that the Commission has given itself a lot of discretion. And am I also correct in understanding that you feel that even countries have a lot of discretion, right, Jeremy?
At the end, this is essentially a proposal to replace rules by a negotiation process. And that negotiation process is not constrained very much. It is constrained in a rather minimalistic way, at least at the current stage of the proposal.
Okay. Very good. That's very clear. Gregory, do you agree with this?
Well, I tend to agree that the proposal is kind of ambiguous. So I agree with Jeremy on that front. But let me, for the sake of the debate, try to defend the Commission. My first point is that this is just a communication from the Commission. It's not a legislative proposal. So there is still room for details later. There is still room for negotiation between countries in the Council. And for instance, about the high probability to be on a declining path. It's true that they didn't say exactly what this probability should be, but it's good because this way a country will be able to negotiate on that front. Should it be 90%? Should it be 100%? Should it be 60%? It's not yet well defined. However, I also find in the proposal some point that shows that the Commission in the end want to be constraining and is kind of ambitious. For instance, on page 11, they mentioned that they want to ensure that a significant part of the consolidation need to take front loaded and need to take place in the first 4 years in order not to be left to future governments. So it means that some significant part of the consolidation will have to be upfront. So that's a good sign. The second thing is that in some place, actually, I looked at the annex of the proposal, and the annex, they make a reference to the current methodology of the DSA of the Commission. And in this methodology, they say that for countries that have like high debt, basically above 90%, those countries in the DSA, they need to have like a declining path of debt to GDP ratio with a very high probability. Actually, it's like basically 100% probability that they need to fulfill. So if you really want debt to GDP ratio to be on a declining path with certainty, it means that the baseline will be on a steep path, in my view. So in that sense, okay, it's not clear yet. It's still very ambiguous. There is still room for discussion. But I still think that I find some hint here and there that the Commission's proposal is more ambitious than actually what we thought at the beginning when we had the first read of the proposal.
It's very strange that you want to be ambitious, though, and only have hints about it, right? I mean, if you want to be ambitious, you ought to be a little bit more clear. Zsolt?
Let me add that this declining path of the public debt ratio after 4 or 7 years must happen under unchanged fiscal policies after 4 or 7 years. So this means that, you know, in the adjustment period, basically all the fiscal adjustment have to be done. And after that, the Commission will make a simulation with macroeconomic models for an additional 10 years. And in this additional 10 years, if there will be no change to fiscal policy, the public debt to GDP ratio must decline at the appropriate or plausible pace. And I think this is a kind of safeguard that, you know, countries will indeed have to do the adjustment in the first 4 years, because otherwise, you know, if they don't do that, the public debt to GDP ratio will not decline. And the second safeguard is that the standard excessive deficit procedure, which is based on the 3% deficit, will also apply in the first 4 years. So if you know, a country will have a budget deficit much higher than 3%, that country will be placed under the excessive deficit procedure. In fact, one of the issues which is unclear to me from the proposal is that the Commission says that the excessive deficit procedure would remain unchanged for breaches of the 3% GDP deficit reference value. But I don't know how they reconcile this condition with the net expenditure growth path that they propose, because in the current excessive deficit procedure, if a country breaches the 3%, then it will have to do a fiscal adjustment amounting to at least 0.5% of GDP each year. So the current EDP clearly defines what is the minimum level of adjustment based on the structural balance. So I think this sentence, which says that it will remain completely unchanged, is not compatible with the new expenditure rules. So this needs to be clarified. Nevertheless, the bottom line is that still the EDP will apply also in the first 4 years, and under the EDP, certainly the Commission and the Council have a stronger power of influencing the fiscal adjustment of the country.
But the procedure also, the communication also says that what they envisage would happen under the EDP is that the EDP would use the adjustment proposal from the Commission, right? The reference path, as to describe the degree of fiscal effort that the country is suspected to do under the EDP, right? And so it really all comes down to whether that reference adjustment scenario is sufficiently ambitious or not. And like you said here, you know, there are hints that it might be, but the worry is that, you know, even if you are supposed to do all the adjustment in the first 4 years, at the end, you know, if it ends up with a plausibly declining debt path, plausibly declining could be interpreted as something that declines steadily but at glacial speed. And so if that's what they mean, that's not good enough for high-risk countries. Now, I hope that that's not what they mean. What they mean, if they mean at sufficiently high probability, that would then imply that the median path actually declines at much higher speed, right? But that remains to be confirmed. And I'm not completely reassured by Grigori's reference to the current DSA approach, because that again introduces these arbitrary distinctions, 90%, 60%, and all that, which ideally you want to get rid of in a holistic DSA.
Let me add one more point. Again, I share Jeremy's concern that the level of ambition has not been defined, and also the text is not clear on what kind of, how fast fiscal adjustment countries we need to do. But let me add one more element of the proposal, which are very, very much like, namely the greatest level of transparency. So the Commission plans to make public all its calculations, all underlying data, all the models which was used for calibrating the initial adjustment path. So anyone, including we at Bruegel and people elsewhere, can check, you know, whether the how the adjustment path was calibrated, whether the models and the assumptions are reasonable, or they are, you know, some favoring some countries and not treating all countries equally. So I think this great level of transparency that the Commission proposes, you know, can also, you know, foster a public debate throughout the EU. You know, national fiscal councils can also come into play and tell their view. Look, the Commission proposal is not sufficiently ambitious, or this or that aspect of the adjustment path is not correct, needs to be amended. So I think the great level of transparency is a kind of assurance that this path will be not set at an arbitrary level, but there will be clear principles applied consistently across the EU.
Okay, if I may, can I just, I, there's one more element that we still need to discuss, which I think is absolutely essential, and that is the enforcement, because we're talking about the design, but actually how do you enforce whatever design you end up having? Up till now, what I hear from you is that in this rules versus discretion trade-off that we've all learned about when we were students, we are now much more on the discretionary side, and Jeroen is arguing perhaps too discretionary. I think Gregory and Zolt are arguing for, no, there's still room for, you know, defining and reducing the discretion to something more contractual, if I may call it this way, so that we can monitor it. But there is one element that I think we need to discuss is how, whatever rules we get, how do we enforce that? What is it new in the current process that is going to reassure us that whatever rule we end up having, we're actually going to enforce it? Jeroen?
So I think the Commission has two answers on that. One is they want to make the existing enforcement channels a bit more credible. In one case, they want to make it more automatic. So, for example, they say if a country has a debt of higher than 60% of GDP and then it deviates from its net expenditure path, so it surpasses the net expenditure path, it automatically gets put into the excessive deficit procedure, which then could lead to loss of access to EU funds, reputational sanctions, small fines, and so forth. So there is a little bit of a strengthening there. Also, the realism of sanctions is better calibrated. So they have these types of improvements. And I think those are very good. I think in particular, of course, the idea that you trigger things automatically makes much more sense if the target that you're violating is truly something you can control than if it's something error prone, which is a point that was made before by Gregory and Jolt. So these things play together. But then, you know, what we, I think, all agree is that with sovereign countries and essentially a political council that has to think about many other things than just fiscal rules, the degree of enforcement from the EU level through withholding financial support, through sanctions, even through reputation, is always a very limited one. So I think there's a sort of broad consensus in the literature, and this is a line that has been pushed particularly by the European members of the European Fiscal Board, is that we shouldn't think about enforcement so much as the thing to improve, but compliance as the thing to improve, right? Behavior needs to improve at the national level. Implementation of the rules needs to improve. And the obvious way to do that, conceptually at least, is to improve national ownership. So countries must be just a lot more at ease with the system than they were in the past. And this really matters. And one area where we can see that it matters is the RRF, the Recovery and Resilience Funds, where countries are broadly cooperating with the framework because they like the framework. It's a reasonable framework. So there is conditionality in the framework, but it is an ex-ante design that is embraced by countries. And so, you know, the claim is that maybe they will comply with the conditions much more than they would have done in another system. And we will see whether this is true when we evaluate this in a few years. So that is sort of the key idea. And here I would argue the proposal really doesn't go far enough in improving national ownership. So it improves national ownership in one sort of very backhanded way, which is by getting rid of useless, contradictory, and irritating little rules. It all automatically improves some national ownership. It gets rid of an irritant. And of course, you know, DSA-based policy advice is just generally much better policy advice. And so countries should be more prepared to follow that advice. So in that sense, it's an improvement. But what is not an improvement is the role of the nation, of the national level in determining the adjustment path has not been really upgraded, right? It's, you know, the commission is completely in the driver's seat. It comes up with this initial reference path. And then at the end, if the council doesn't, if it advises the council that the national path is not good, it's their reference path that's in charge. And so what I would have liked to see is more participation at the national level to make the first step. And of course, with a very strong participation of national independent fiscal institutions, right? And that's not there.
If I may, I mean, so it's interesting that distinction you're making between, you know, the enforcement versus compliance. And I think actually because that is money's behavioral and therefore more credible if successful, but it has to be successful first. And you've mentioned the RRF, where we see that actually happens through cooperation. The Commission actually works very closely with the countries, but we mustn't forget that at least on the grant component, there is exactly that carrot, which is the grant. So, Gregory, if I may come to you on this enforcement thing, I mean, it feels to me like they're going much more in the direction of compliance rather than enforcement because they're imposing this discretion. But do you think that can work?
No, I think it's true that it's more about compliance than enforcement in the sense that we always repeated that if country don't like the rule and don't believe that the rule provides a good recommendation, they will not follow them. So in that sense, if there is more ownership, if they believe that the rules are better, they will comply more easily. However, I have to say that on the enforcement point, first, as Jérôme said, it's more automatic for whether it's for the deficit base. So if you breach the 3%, you should enter an EDP. And now they also reinforce the debt-based EDP path, which is if you deviate from the adjustment path, then you are automatically in an
whatever EDP. That is.
No, yeah,
because that's
if you're about 60%.
Right?
And to be honest, being in an EDP is not neutral. It's like because the ECB actually in its announcement of the TPI in July made the EDP precondition of not being part of an EDP a precondition to have access to the ECB's TPI. Actually, entering an EDP could be like an atomic event in the sense that if market understands that you will be in an EDP and that basically you will lose the easy ECB backstop, then it could be problematic for countries and spread increase quite quickly. So in that sense, this is the stick, in my view, because being in an EDP is not as neutral as it used to be.
Well, that's actually a very good point, linking it to the monetary policy and the possibility of other instruments being triggered actually is hindered in ways that this wasn't before. Well, obviously, the instruments didn't exist before. So, Jolt, what about your views on this, you know, enforcement versus compliance and so effective compliance?
I'm very skeptical whether fiscal rules, European fiscal rules, can be enforced from European-wide institutions on national sovereign governments and parliaments. So I very much agree with Bo, Jérôme and Gregory that countries will follow fiscal rules if there is a great level of national ownership and they believe the rules are right. If they don't like the rules, whatever the EU does, they will naturally follow them. Now, the big question indeed is whether this new framework increases national ownership. I hear, Jérôme, you are very skeptical about that. I have to say I'm a bit more positive. And the reason is that, I mean, this framework also forces member states to make projections for about 20 years ahead, you know, the adjustment period in the next 4 years plus 10 additional years. And you know, in these projections, you know, they have to put real numbers. So they have to put, you know, what kind of GDP growth they expect, what kind of interest rate they expect, what kind of various kind of expenditures on pensions, on other social spending, of course, on public investment they have to do. So it will force countries to really do really long-term plans, 15 years ahead. Think about what this will imply for the public debt adjustment pass. Yes, Jerome is right. You are right that the first proposal will be made by the Commission, but the countries will do the same exercise themselves in their ministries. So they will have their own models, own projections. They will see themselves, you know, look, if I do these policies, simply my public debt will not be reduced in the next 15 years. So it's simply impossible to follow that. So it will force, you know, a much more internal thinking, internal calculations over a really long period, 15 years ahead. And that could, in my view, help a somewhat greater national ownership, even if the initial proposal for the adjustment pass will come from the Commission.
And would be a game changer, right, Zoltan? I mean, if that were to happen. Gregory, you have a point?
No, I just wanted to say something about the DSA. It's true that the Commission basically is the first one to act, but in the end, DSAs are more art than science. So in that sense, there will be a lot of discussion on the assumption. And so I think it will be like a discussion between the Commission and the countries about the assumption, etc. So, yeah, okay, maybe the Commission will go first, but then it will be a negotiation between the two. And maybe actually there will be like heated debate on the assumption. So it's a pro in the sense that it will force countries to think ahead, as Joel said. The con is that it will lead to heated debate. So, but I view it as a way to increase like transparent national ownership in a way.
And that's a very good summary, actually, what you just said. Listen, we are coming to an end, but before we finish this episode, I would like to come back to you and ask you, as Gregory told us, this isn't written in stone. There is still room for changing this. If you were to, you know, given what we are now, given this proposal, if you were to change one thing, or that you wish one thing were changed before it became legislation, what would that be? Let me start with you, Gregory.
No, I think the main point is the one that was mentioned by Jérôme at the beginning, is that there is a lot of ambiguity, and especially about the calibration. So the calibration is crucial about the adjustment pass. So I think calibrating well this adjustment pass is the most important point that need to be discussed in the next few months.
Zolt?
Yeah, I share Gregory's view on that and Jérôme's view on that. I mean, let me add them a more technical one. Is that the indicator, the net expenditure, will of course exclude net discretionary revenue measures, as we also suggested, also exclude interest expenditures and cyclical unemployment expenditure. Now I have 2 points on that. I mean, first, the estimation of cyclical unemployment expenditure is also very problematic. We also looked at in the past, and it was very also very uncertain. So it still incorporates some undesirable feature of the previous framework. And second, I mean, it's also a bit unclear how public investment will be incorporated in the net adjustment pass. So certainly more clarity will be needed on that.
Yeah, great. Thank you. Yeah, Romain, you have the last word.
So I agree with everything that Grégory and Jolt have just said, and I would add one extra point, which I hinted at before. I really think the reference pass should come from the national level. Ideally, it should come from an empowered, independent national fiscal institution. So, you know, the assessment of what the debt sustainability analysis implies for the ambitiousness of debt reduction for the net expenditure path is a technical assessment, which is probably the reason why the Commission thinks it wants to go first. But that technical capacity can also exist at the country level, ideally residing in an independent fiscal institution, or it should come from the member state itself under the scrutiny of an independent fiscal institution. And of course, using independent output projections, which are absolutely critical. So I would, in a sense, turn around the order in which the process works.
Okay, wonderful. That's great. I'm afraid this is all we have time for today. Thank you very much for coming to the discussion today. I'm sure we will write more on this, both at the high level, but also more on the details of how to calibrate DSAs in the future. But, you know, watch this space. You can find all our writings and all our announcements for events at our website on www.brugel.org. But that's all we have time for today. Thank you very much and see you next time. Bye.